Chattering Mists is devoted to the most important segment of our society. To those of you who have come to realize that the world's political, religious, military, and economic institutions are corrupt, that they are actually counterproductive, and that they cannot be fixed. Our mission, therefore, is to know who is working against our interests, to understand why and how they are doing so, because exposing and condemning such schemes, even when they're patriotic, political, and religious, isn't hateful. It's caring. Today, in our second and probably third hour, we're going to explore what the Torah has to say about Shavuah. Today is the celebration of Shavuah. Shavuah means the promise of the Shabbat, the promise of seven. And so we will continue to examine what God has to say about this day. Our phone number, if you'd like to participate in our discussion, is toll-free, 877-300-7645. This article begins by saying, former prisoner of war, Sergeant Bo Bergdahl's father, and before we consider what Bob had to say, Sergeant Bo Bergdahl was not a prisoner of war. He was a captive. Somewhere along the way, he was kidnapped and detained. But he's not a prisoner of war. The United States has not declared war against the Taliban. The United States has not declared war against Afghanistan. In fact, we don't even have a beef against the Taliban or Afghanistan. You know, the Taliban was an organization that the United States rented from the Pakistani government to fight a proxy war against the Soviet Union during the Carter administration. You know, we've used them as a tool, as an ally. The Taliban did not plan 9/11. They didn't staff 9/11. They didn't perpetrate 9/11. You know, the Taliban was conceived for a singular purpose. And it was conceived before the United States rented them from the Pakistani government. The Taliban was conceived for the express purpose of giving the Pakistani government and military control over Afghanistan. And the purpose was that after there had been this massive discovery of oil and gas in the Caspian Sea, it became a race as to who was going to be able to extract that gas and oil. You see, the Caspian Sea is landlocked. And you have, you know, at the time, the Soviet Union had touched it. Many of those republics that are now independent tells you why the Chechnya area is so important to Russia, because it still gives Russia direct access to the Caspian Sea. But it lost many of the Islamic Caucasus regions that were proximate to the Caspian Sea. But the Russians began building pipelines to the Caspian Sea because they had access to it and still do through Chechnya. The Chinese began building pipelines to it. You know, China goes very far west. Most people think of China as being the Far East, but, you know, the western part of China borders on Afghanistan and is in a region that pipelines make sense for China. And so they began to build the pipelines. But so did Iran. The southern part of the Caspian Sea is in Iran. So, long story short, the government of Pakistan, which does not have any oil or gas, therefore it's dependent on other Islamic countries and on grants from countries like the United States, realized that if they could get control over Afghanistan, then they could build a pipeline from the Caspian Sea through Afghanistan and then through Pakistan and tax the flow of the oil and gas to a free water port. It's very much like the Ukraine. Ukraine doesn't have significant oil or gas reserves, but Russians built a pipeline through the Ukraine when Ukraine was part of the USSR, and the independent country of the Ukraine gets a percentage of the gas that flows through that pipeline as a royalty for allowing the pipeline to transit their territory. That's why the Taliban was created. It was created to undermine the government of Afghanistan and the independence of Afghanistan, to give control of Afghanistan to the Pakistanis. That was the purpose of it. They are not an international terrorist organization, unless you consider their involvement in Afghanistan motivated and directed from Pakistan as international. But that's the entire scope of their world. And so as a prisoner of the Haqqani network of the Taliban, Bo Bergdahl was not a prisoner of war. He was not captured in a military operation, and he was not held by an entity that the United States has declared war against. So we really ought to be careful with our terms. Now, let's go to what Bob Bergdahl had to say. Bob is Bo's dad. Well, he is under fire today for remarks that he made on Twitter in the days leading up to his son's controversial release. According to the New York Daily News, Bob Bergdahl established a dialogue with the Taliban online in order to ensure his son's safety. 3 days before Bo's release, Bob Bergdahl tweeted, now this was on it was on the Voice of Jihad website, or tweet source. when you post a tweet, I don't know exactly how you, I'm not a Twitter fan, but, the website, that, he tweeted to, is called Voice of Jihad. This is what he had to say. Now, this is 3 days before Bo's release. Quote, I am working to free all Guantanamo prisoners. Allah will repay for the death of every Afghan child. Amin. End quote. Takes your breath away. First of all, the President of the United States had at his side Bob Bergdahl when he announced the exchange for the five Taliban officers for Bo Bergdahl. He had at his side a man who the 3 days prior to that had written, Allah will repay for the death of every Afghan child. Amin. Now, if the President of the United States has an NSA capability that Americans pay tens, if not hundreds of billions of dollars a year to keep up, that is willing to infringe on the U.S. Constitution to keep the U.S. government in control over its people. If the U.S. government spends tens of billions of dollars in the Department of Defense intelligence capabilities, if the U.S. government has, at the cost of tens of billions of dollars, the CIA and the FBI, if the U.S. government spends billions of dollars a year on the staff for the President of the United States, and the President of the United States, knowing mean, this man, Bob Bergdahl, has not flown under the radar. He has knowingly accepted the ways of the Taliban. He has been very public in his rhetoric. And yet, the President of the United States had standing next to him a man who said, Allah will repay for the death of every Afghan child. Amen. I mean, that tells you that the President of the United States and his staff are incompetent. You don't do that on any circumstance. Even if you want Bo, even if you think there's a in fact, I don't think the government wanted Bo at all. They all they wanted was to reengage in dialogue with the Taliban because they want to push through the we've had it with Afghanistan. Let's just get the Taliban to agree that they won't promote international terrorism and we'll call it peace with honor and be out of here. And so the only way you can get the Taliban to say that and make that statement credible is for you to be in negotiations with them. And the whole purpose of this was to reengage the Taliban in negotiations. They had no interest in Bo. He's irrelevant to it. But, oh, my God, if you're President of the United States, you're Commander-in-Chief of the Armed Forces of the United States, you don't have someone standing next to you who wrote and posted, promoted, Allah will repay for the death of every Afghan child. That's stunning. Stunningly incompetent. Stunningly inappropriate. And with all of the resources the U.S. government has to have that man do that. In addition to that, of course, he began his remarks by giving the most common Islamic greeting. That, too, was inappropriate. I am amazed by this for a lot of reasons, of course. One is that this rage that comes out of Americans having killed Afghan children, Afghan women as well, is the primary rage that fuels their ability to recruit jihadists. And what we'll talk about when we return is the fact that the Muslims have actually killed 100 times more women and children than have the Americans. It's purely hypocritical. Bo Bergdahl's father, Bob, posted, Allah will repay for the death of every American child. And this man then stood beside the President of the United States the day that his son was exchanged for 5 Taliban senior officers. What that is, my friends, is an invitation for Muslims to kill non-Muslims, particularly Americans. It is not just an open invitation for good Muslims to kill non-Muslims, and particularly Americans. It is a sanction from Allah. It is their duty. If they want to be with their God, they must join their God's cause. And according to Bob Bergdahl, and by the way, according to really every fundamentalist Muslim, Allah avenges deaths. And so what you have here is an open invitation from a man standing next to the President of the United States to kill Americans. That's what happened here. This is really serious. The source here, by the way, you know, I'm not reading this from a blog. This was posted on the New York Daily News website. And they have absolute proof that he posted it and even to where it was posted. And it tells you that the United States government is absolutely incompetent, that is run by a bunch of bumbling boobs for them not to know that. And if they knew it and they posted him next to the president, the commander-in-chief of the military, a man who had just said, it's open hunting season on Americans, go after him, you're justified, then that's grotesquely immoral as opposed to just being completely blind and ignorant. Now, the truth is that when you engage in a war in somebody else's country, like America did in Vietnam, like we did in Iraq and Afghanistan, when you deploy your military and invade countries, as we did in those three cases, all your opponent has to do is point up at the sky, at the bombs that are being dropped, or at the guns that are being fired, and say, who's your enemy? And when loved ones and neighbors are killed, it doesn't take much to instill the kind of rage that is necessary to get lots of people to sign up for the cause and to be willing to sacrifice their loss with their lives. It is why in Vietnam, with every Viet Cong we killed, with every Vietnamese citizen we killed, we manufactured 100 more enemy. In the case of Afghanistan, the same thing is true. With every person killed, 100 more were manufactured. Now, there were deliberate and there were collateral Afghani children killed. Many collateral damage. And many deliberate. Now, not deliberate on the orders of the U.S. government, but deliberate by U.S. soldiers. Went into homes and slaughtered women and children. Happened a lot. And from a collateral damage point of view, it happened a great deal more. Now, the reality is that that the claim is hypocritical on behalf of Muslims. But keep in mind, this is the primary unifying claim of jihadists worldwide. We're not talking about, when Bob Bergdahl cited this, he wasn't citing something that this was his opinion. He had researched his subject, and he realized that Allah avenging the death of women and children, of Muslim women and children, was the rallying cry of jihadists worldwide. It is, folks. What he said is the primary rallying cry, the slogan, of fundamentalist Muslim terrorists the world over. That's why this is so serious. Now, as is the case of every religious devotee, they're dumb as a stone. The fact is that Muslims, fundamentalist Islamic terrorists, kill at least 100 Muslim women and children for every one that is killed by a non-Muslim. So if Allah is going to avenge the deaths of every Afghan child, he's going to have to begin by killing the Taliban. Now, they don't see it that way because, of course, they're religious and therefore irrational. But nonetheless, these facts are all true, and this is an extremely serious situation. The risk that the Obama administration took in trading 5 senior Taliban officers in Gitmo for a U.S. Army deserter, Bo Bergdahl, was that by negotiating with individuals who are prone to kidnap, who are naturally inspired by their religion and by Muhammad to kidnap, that you will increase the number of Americans in particular that they kidnap to earn the release of their operatives, their officers from jails and prisons around the world. I mean, that was the absolute guarantee that was going to occur. That would be the absolute consequence of this negotiation, is you make average American citizens and your soldiers vastly more vulnerable by doing this. Now, the reason, of course, that the U.S. government did it was because they want to do the same thing that Richard Nixon did in Vietnam. They realized the Afghan war has made a bad situation worse, just like Vietnam did, and that there is no means whatsoever to achieve victory. And so since you can't achieve victory, since there is no way to prevail, since the reality is we made a bad situation worse, you would normally think you would just leave. But see, that can't be done in the American psyche. Americans can't fathom the idea that they were unsuccessful militarily. So Americans, particularly politicians and generals, can't do the moral thing, which is to admit they made a mistake and to leave. And they will continue to sacrifice lives simply to promote a political agenda and to continue to promote the myth of invincibility. So in Vietnam, the Nixon administration continued to keep the North Vietnamese communists at the table to negotiate peace with honor, knowing full well that whatever the North Vietnamese finally agreed to, which would be next to nothing, that they wouldn't adhere to it anyway. But the president could declare peace with honor, bring the troops home, and whatever happened, happened. It was obvious what's going to happen. It was as if we had never been there, with exception of all of the deaths and the spilled wealth, spilled blood and coin. Well, the same thing is true in Afghanistan. There is no set of circumstances where Afghanistan can be resolved. We made a bad situation worse. There were no way to win. And we're staying there until some administration can negotiate some deal that won't be adhered to anyway with the Taliban. And so to accomplish that, to move that along, that's why this administration engaged in this discussion. But in doing so, they made every American more vulnerable. And that was up until the point that we learned that Bergdahl's father said, Allah will repay for the death of every Afghan child. Feeding into the Islamic psyche, the very rallying cry that motivates them to be terrorists the world over. Virtually every Islamic suicide bomber is fed this line before they kill. This is a stunningly disastrous move. Now, I'm going to move on. I'm going to continue to talk, by the way, about this family. But you need to know, if you're a patriotic American, if you are a pro-military American, that you've got some real serious issues with your president, with your military, with your government. Now, the New York Daily News says the tweet was deleted, but not before other users were able to take screenshots showing that it was directed to @AAbalki, the Twitter handle of Abdul Kahar Balki, a website claiming to be the voice of jihad. The site posts updates on the Mujahideen's operations against American invaders, U.S. terrorists, and their Afghan puppets, according to the Daily News. The previous tweet from Bergdahl in March saying democracy is a cult in the West has also raised some eyebrows, according to the Daily Mail, which is a London newspaper. At a White House press conference announcing his son's release, Bob Bergdahl sported a bushy beard that he had not trimmed since his son went missing, all to identify more closely with the Taliban. And he spoke Pashto, the Afghan language that is spoken by the Taliban, as well as Arabic, citing the Islamic greeting. CNN is reporting, when Bob Bergdahl was formally introduced to America in the White House Rose Garden beside President Barack Hussein Obama, he was startling to see, startling to hear at first. The president, the father, had morphed into an Afghan tribesman. He was wearing a long beard, even speaking Pashto, of course, and also giving Islamic greetings. Bob Bergdahl, it says in the CNN article, taught his son ethics from the classics. Yesterday we had quite a discussion as to when Bo Bergdahl wrote his family and said that he wanted out, that he was tired of being part of the lie, that he thought what America was doing in Afghanistan was repulsive, that it was an abomination. And he went on and on to speak about how bad America's involvement, how ill-advised, how counterproductive, how immoral America's role in Afghanistan actually was. And it's true that that happens to be the truth. It is grotesquely inappropriate, counterproductive, and immoral. And so we're sitting there, you know, how did this confused individual come up with a moral conclusion that was accurate? And it was Glenn who said, you know, I don't think this young man is particularly well coached in terms of his morality. Well vetted in terms of his morality. And I don't want to ever speak for individuals that I don't know. I do not know this young man. I can tell you that I happen to agree with Glenn that, you know, at the very least, he bought into the American propaganda on the war and joined the military. And, you know, it took him a long time before he finally says, I want out. And the way that he decided to leave was inappropriate. But it brings up, you know, lots of issues as to how you can't leave the U.S. military. Once you're in, they own you. And when you come to realize that what the military is doing is wrong, it's very difficult to get out. And all he really wanted was to get out. But the fact is that that Bo Bergdahl is hardly a paradigm of virtue. And so the CNN article talks about the basis for Bo's ethics. And according to the story, Bob Bergdahl, the dad, taught his son, homeschooled him, from the classics. His parents are devout Calvinists who homeschooled their son and all of their children 6 hours a day and taught them the theologies of Thomas Aquinas, and St. Augustine. Quote, ethics and morality would be constant verbiage in our conversations, Bergdahl told a magazine that was interviewing him. Bo was definitely instilled with the truth. He was very philosophical about perceiving ethics, end quote. A Calvinist is an individual that is has accepted predestination. Calvin's is a leader in Protestant theology, which is interesting, of course, because Augustine is probably the foremost voice of Roman Catholicism. Calvin is primarily Presbyterian, but certainly uniformly accepted Protestant voice, at least amongst most Protestants. His salient doctrine is the same as Augustine, predestination. Now, the moment you get into predestination, ethics becomes immaterial. choice becomes immaterial. Free will is no longer extant. I mean, there is no purpose for life once you accept the Calvinist and Augustinian view on predestination. You just might as well surrender, because nothing you do, nothing you say, nothing you choose matters. So this idea that you can have a philosophical discussion about ethics and that you can even identify the truth under a Calvinistic scheme is a fool's folly. Now, what I want to do is, as I understand, this is a stretch from the story, but I think that it has merit to consider Augustine. He's had such an effect on the world today. He is such a dominant voice in Roman Catholicism. You know, his City of God is considered one of the great books ever written. So when we return to Shattering Myths, we have Glenn on the line who will add his comments to this discussion, and we will pursue what Augustine really stood for. So we have an idea of what the mindset was of Bo Bergdahl. We understand this man that the President of the United States chose to trade 5 Taliban officers to release. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. Before we consider the City of God and the errant view of one Augustine, I'd like to get Glenn's perspective on all of this. Hello, Glenn. What do you think about the quotation of the man that stood by the President of the United States? Hello, Glenn. Are you with us?
Oh, yes, I am.
Yeah, okay.
I just said someone's name. I don't know if you know how to keep crossing that. Was speaking to someone on the side here. Calvinism is just a tiptoe through the tulip. You know, total depravity, unconditional election, limited atonement, irresistible grace, and perseverance of the saint.
Yeah.
How can the clay say to the potter, why hast thou made me thus?
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Well, why bother with anything? I mean, it is also interesting, of course, that Calvin is amongst the most influential of all Protestant theologians, and Augustine is the most, easily the most influential of all Catholic theologians, and they agree on most everything.
Right. Right. I have a copy of City of God around somewhere, and I'm pretty sure I have a 2-volume set of Calvin's Institutes laying around somewhere. None of which are well thumbed, I'm afraid.
They aren't
them a few times.
Yeah, they aren't worth reading. As a matter of fact, the City of God was written over a 13-year period, beginning 413 CE, and that timing happens to coincide with the fall of Rome. Rome had been sacked, and so what Augustine was attempting to do is to disassociate Christianity from the fall of Rome. So, you know, many in Rome were saying, well, Rome fell because it gave up its traditional gods and it chose this crazy new religion that was a pacifist religion, and so it became susceptible to the barbarians. But which was really interesting, is that most of the barbarians that sacked Rome were actually Christians by this time. So he was writing, trying to defend Christianity.
Right.
And he wanted to separate.
He's sort of the Reinhold Niebuhr of his day.
Right. Yeah. He wanted to separate the Christianity from the decadence of Rome while associating Christianity with the Church of Rome. And, of course, you can't do that because the Church of Rome became the most decadent expression of Rome. And, you know,
and strangely enough, he himself was candid about his own struggles with sexuality.
Oh, of course, yes. And he had his issues. In fact, according to Augustine, the City of God is the Roman Catholic Church. Well, according to Yahweh, the Church of Rome is the beast.
Is, his babble. He had the horror babble.
Absolutely. God talks about in Daniel 7 how the beast that was the Roman Empire isn't dead, that it continued to live and it infected the entire world. Well, the only way that the beast of Rome lives and has infected the entire world is through the Roman Catholic and Eastern Orthodox Church. There are no alternatives here.
Yeah.
And so, you know, Augustine was writing on behalf of the very thing that God was condemning.
Right. Right.
Now,
I get the feeling it's always reared its ugly head just repeatedly, ever since the Tower of Babel, you know.
Correct. Well, you know, God's presentation in Daniel 7 of the rise and fall of civilizations begins with the fall of Babel, of Babylon, and then proceeds through Persia and Greece, the Macedonian Empire of Alexander, and then to Rome, and saying that the Roman beast is unlike the beast that preceded it, in a way that it continues to live. And then but it's interesting that when you survey the progression from Babylon to Persia, from Persia to Greece, from Greece to Rome, from Rome to the church, what you find is that really nothing changes. And the reason that God provided us with that chronology is that nothing changed. Same gods, same religion, same military approach, same antagonism to the Torah and to the covenant and to Yahweh. They all grew out of one another, right?
The pantheon just became the same.
Yeah.
You know?
When you read the two Babylons, and with one being the kingdom of Babylon that only existed for 66 years, and then the second reincarnation of Babylon is the Roman Catholic Church, the affinities are simply overwhelming. And so, yes, they have. They've all morphed one into another. We'll be back with Shattering Myths after the news and commercial break. Stay with us.